Hey, na gute Woche. Tschüss. So, I'm sure everybody's aware, this might not be the most popular halacha of Hanukkah, is that there's no din to make a seudah. Hanukkah parties are not a requirement. A little disappointing to hear that. Yet, the halacha tells us how you can turn it into a seudas mitzvah if you want to, right? If it's dedicated to praising Hashem, not just to playing cards. But whatever the case is, we have no chiyuv seudah on Hanukkah. And here the famous question and answer, which I'm sure everybody is already familiar with, but I want to address to study it in more depth, is why is it that on Hanukkah the celebration is purely spiritual, meaning the what was actually instituted to celebrate Hanukkah is Hallel and lighting the menorah, it's actual praise to Hashem and the performance of a mitzvah, and that's all. No need to what we would call celebrate. Whereas on Purim, the mitzvah is mishta v'simcha, celebration, party. The question is famous and the answer is famous. I'm sure everybody's already heard it. And the answer, as it's stated in short, is that since in Hanukkah the story was about Ruchnius, was about spirituality, they weren't after our bodies. Therefore, this celebration is in the spiritual realm. Whereas on Purim, when they were after our bodies, there the celebration is in the physical realm. That's famous. But I want to actually approach it. The source of this answer, the source of this explanation is the Bach. And in the Bach, it's actually more detailed. And I found that this holds many of the principles and of the sentiments surrounding the essence of what Hanukkah is. So in the Bach, and this is what I want to spend some time on, go through it step by step, the way I'll call it a five-step program, where the Bach lines up Hanukkah versus Purim and shows how there's five steps to what happened in each one on the physical trail and the other on the spiritual trail. So what happened? He says that both in the case of Hanukkah and Purim, they followed the same five steps. There was an Avera that was done. Because of that Avera, a punishment came. There was a Gezeira. There was a decree against the Jewish people. As a result of the decree, the Jewish people did tshuva. As a result of the tshuva, Hashem brought the salvation. And as a result of the salvation, we instituted a Yom Tov, we instituted a celebration. Okay, so those are the five steps. Aveira, failing on the part of Klal Yisrael, national Aveira, national failing, a national punishment, tshuva, national tshuva, a Yeshua, salvation, and then as a result, the takana of the Yom Tov. Those are the five steps. In Purim, these were all in the physical realm. In Chanukah, these were all in the spiritual realm. Now, we won't talk about Purim now, just touch on it for reference, but let's focus on the five steps of Chanukah and see what it actually means. So the way the Bach says it is that where was the Aveira that brought about the whole Gezeira of Chanukah? So his wording is, Al shenisrashlu min ha'avoda. They became lax in the Avoda. What does that mean? What that means is, it was in a very broad way, we'll say it was a phenomenon of Hellenization. The people started getting swept up with Greek culture and going off in that direction. So it was a laxness in holding on to the Torah. I'm going to come back to all those things and try to really connect to them in a practical way and appreciate what's actually being conveyed here. That resulted in a gezeira in the spiritual realm. You started loosening your hold on the Torah, and you started deteriorating in Torah. The Torah is taken away from you. Shmad, right? Nobody was out to kill them if they were ready to drop it all. No more Torah. That was the Gzeirah. The tshuva was, the way the Bach puts it down, Shemasu nafshom, that they dedicated themselves to the Avodah with intense sacrifice. That was how they rectified the original sin. Point was that the Gzeirah came directly related, directly addressing the sin, right? You were dropping Ruchnius, you lost your Ruchnius. You dedicated yourself extra to Ruchnius, you got it back. That was the tshuva, that was the Yeshua, that we got it back. And as a result, the takana was, we're going to celebrate Ruchnius. This is not about partying, this is about celebrating Ruchnius. In other words, we'll just start from the end and then we'll make our way back. When we talk about celebration, what's the most basic way of saying thank you for something? What would you expect if you give a present to a one-year-old child who can't even speak yet? Even more basic than saying thank you. What do you want to see? You don't really expect anything of him. What do you want to see? You want to see him playing with it. You want to see him enjoying it, right? So this is the most basic way of showing our appreciation. Hashem gave us back Ruchnius, so we're going to celebrate it with Ruchnius. And this is why the celebration of Chanukah is Hallel. It's the addition of another mitzvah. And I remember when I was in Mir, I didn't go to Rabbi Shari Eli's shir, but I remember the chevre from his shir saying that that they were in the middle of a very intense sugya, sugya Vikar, sugya Chanukah. And he opened the shir by saying, what are we celebrating? We're celebrating the fact that they didn't want us to learn this sugya of Roy Vikarev, and now we're going to learn it. So let's throw ourselves into it in celebration. Whereas with Purim, it was the body that was going to be taken away. We got the body back. We show our appreciation, yes, by utilizing the body. Now that's something that we're going to, Mitzvah Hashem, we never, we'll see if we'll touch on that Purim time. Where? In Purim, it was Nanu Misudasei Shel Achashverosh, right? It was a very physical business. Yeah, the feast. Yeah. Okay. So now let's back up a little and really look at each of these things one by one and appreciate their relevance. So let's go back. Stage number one. The Aveira was Shenisrashlu min Avodah. They became lax in the Avodah. What exactly does that mean? So just to touch on the reality of the time, see, Chanukah is a little bit more, there's actually more ambiguity surrounding Chanukah because we don't have, it's not like a Sefer in Tanakh where we have a full story explaining exactly what happens. We know bits and pieces. We know a story here, a story there. But let's get back into the historic context. What happened was that the Jews who were living in Eretz Yisrael, Greek influence was starting to spread. And we're going to elaborate a bit. This is still a little bit simplistic, but we're going to just to get into the reality of it a bit further than just a superficial understanding. Greek influence started to spread. Now, let's appreciate the Greek influence was really an advance for mankind in general. It was really changing the face of the world. Up till then, it was all about these very primitive, backward, superstitious religions and cultures. And Alexander the Great, who was a Talmid of Aristotle, the Greek philosophers were very, very great Chachamim. They really brought human understanding to leaps and bounds to completely new levels. They were introducing a new era of enlightenment and of a very big step forward in terms of the world's level in general. And Alexander was actually interested, besides being a conqueror, he was also interested in spreading the culture and bringing it in, advancing the world, moving the world forward out of the dark ages into a new, enlightened, more educated, more cultured reality. And for most of the nations that he conquered, this was great news. They were very happy. They see a new, brilliant, sophisticated era that really brings mankind to new levels. And they were more than happy to drop their old backward ways, their old primitive ways. They didn't feel all that much loyalty to the primitive practices of their father and their grandfather. And They were happy to trade it in. Greek culture was a wonderful thing to embrace. And it was spreading, and it was spreading. And then it started spreading over Eretz Yisrael too. Let's talk before the actual Gezeiros happened. Let's just talk about the battle of Greek culture in and of itself. When suddenly there's this new, very enlightened mode that's really transforming the face of the whole civilized world. Everybody is moving into this new age. And the weak among Klal Yisrael, they started saying, this is what's taking over the world. This is what's taking over the world. The weak started going for it. The weak started going for it. Now let's appreciate another point. It wasn't like necessarily black and white. Either you were keeping Torah mitzvahs or you were subscribing to Greek culture. We know that there are, if you just look at today's reality, there are a million shades of gray in the middle. And the question is, you can either be the person who just dropped it all, but you can be the person who was trying to get the best of both worlds. You can be the person who was trying to get three quarters of world, one world and a quarter of the other world, and everything in the middle. I'm sorry? Cryptic?
From where were they from? Yeah. They're from Spain.
I'm not sure. I'm not
Spain.
familiar with the.
Okay. Ramadan.
Oh, okay, yeah, that was Spain. Okay. So what happens? Again, there's a lot of politics and complexity surrounding this, but basically what happens is it reaches a point where one of the Hellenizers, one of the fans of the new culture was a guy by the name of Jason. You probably heard the name in the different historic context. A fellow by the name of Jason, who Yason, I don't know, it was a Greek name. He was a Jew. And he was a real a fan of the new culture. And he bought the position of Kohen Gadol from the Greek rulers. This was already the introducing a new trend. Kohen Gadol had held a lot of power, also political power. And that's why these people were looking to that as something that we'd like to get our hands on. And he actually purchased the position of Kohen Gadol from the Greek rulers. And he had an agenda. What did he do? What he went and did was he built a gymnasium, a great Greek gymnasium on Har HaBayis. I don't know exactly how close, but adjacent to the Beis HaMikdash. Adjacent to the Beis HaMikdash. With the idea being that, the Kohanim are very intensely involved in the Avodah. Let them have a chance to be a part of this also. It'll be a good outlet, et cetera, et cetera. And what actually started happening was that, yes, you had Kohanim who would spend time at the gymnasium. Again, like we said, why can't you get the best of both worlds? Being introduced to the culture, competing with the Greek chevra who are there, making, that Kiddush Hashem, that kind of Kiddush Hashem, when you show that a Jew can be just as good a wrestler as a non-Jew, or that a Jew can be a basketball star. It's a very specific strain of Kiddush Hashem. It's called the inferior complex style Kiddush Hashem. Okay. A Jew can bang a banjo drum like any native in the jungle. A Jew can do all the things that any lowlife can do. We can compete with all that. So, I'm not putting down basketball, Chas v'Shalom. Certainly a sport, that's fine, if you want. But I'm talking about when it turns into, the ideal, when it turns into an ideal, a pursuit as in almost ideological. Almost or not almost. Just having fun for the sake of having fun, that's not what we're talking about now. We're talking about the culture of it and the need to excel and the need to show quite what a Jew can accomplish in these areas. And okay, they started getting involved. Now, in these places, I guess that in our basketball courts today, they wear shorts and sleeveless shirts. I guess that was an innovation that was introduced later. But back in the original Greek gymnasiums, they didn't have those either. And this presented a problem because the body of the Jew who has a bris milah looks different than that of a Greek. This created, of course, Chilul Hashem. You know, that kind of, it's the flip side of the coin. Chilul Hashem is when a Jew looks different than other people, right? I hope everybody realizes that I'm being cynical, but if a Jew, you know, stands up for his ideals and shows that he is not going to be Mechal Shabbos when everybody else is around him, you have the weaklings who call that Chilul Hashem. So this started becoming a Chilul Hashem. You have a person who you see the bris milah on his body, call it Chilul Hashem, or just embarrassed of the cool guys. The two go together. Okay? This was this very specific strain of Chilul Hashem, where we don't want them seeing the Jews are not like everybody else. So what actually happened was they started doing things to their body to make their bris milah not be apparent. One thing was leading to another, but the truth is th this is a detail. But in the broader picture, what was happening? The broader picture, what was happening? What was happening was something that went that ran a bit deeper. The avodah in the Beis HaMikdash is meant to be a very intense business. It demands a lot of, first of all, a lot of learning. The halachas of the karbanis, that anybody in the learning world today knows that kachim is a very difficult area of Torah. You don't have to be a boy in the Mismedrash, Vayikra, right? You've learned Vayikra. Vayikra is a very difficult area of Torah. When you take it from there to Kachim, Masechta Zvachim, Masechta Monachos, these are from the very tough, formidable areas. Kohanim had to be very, very well versed in that, besides all the rest of Torah. Not just Kachim, also Taurus. Those are two massive areas of Torah that constitute a third of the Mishnah, meaning a whole added third of halacha that we don't have today. I mean, we today have two-thirds of the full body of halacha. And those two bodies that are missing, I say two-thirds, even that meaning counting Zroim. So if they said not counting Zroim, we have half of the full body of Torah. Let's say we count Zroim because today it's actually practiced in Eretz Yisrael. You're missing Kachim and Taurus, which are two major areas, major complex areas of halacha. And these were things that the Kohanim had to be very, very well versed in. So this required a lot of intense learning. Now, besides that, to actually perform the Avodah was also a very precise, intense business. It had to be done quickly, with a lot of speed, and a lot of precision. That's why going to the Beis HaMikdash and watching the Avodah was a very inspiring process, because you saw the intense precision of Avodas Hashem carrying itself out like a machine, perfectly orchestrated, perfect synchrony of a whole team of Kohanim going through complex processes where everything had to be exactly just so with a lot of speed. Now, let's appreciate another point, that this whole system of Avodah, the Beis HaMikdash, with all of its complexity, it was actually the means of harnessing the Shekhinah b'Yisrael. The Beis HaMikdash was the seat of the Shekhinah b'Yisrael. Shekhinah all around Eretz Yisrael emanated from the Beis HaMikdash. It was kiviyachol the power plant. You have the power plant from where the electricity spreads around to the whole city. So this, it was the avodah in the Beis HaMikdash that actually brought the Shekhinah, kiviyachol, brought the Shekhinah down to our world. And from there, it spread out to all the rest of Eretz Yisrael. And this rode directly on the avodah of the Kohanim in the Beis HaMikdash. Meaning as follows: Hashuras HaShechina is not necessarily a question of yes or no. It's also a question of how much. Let's say a Kohen performed the avodah not on a lechatchila level, but on a bidyeved level. That manifested in a weaker Hashuras HaShechina, bidyeved Hashuras HaShechina. And let's say, rather than doing lechatchila, he did the avodah with all of the hidurim. The Hashuras HaShechina was that much more intense and that much more enhanced. And let's say, on top of that, right, on top of all the precision and intensity in actually performing it, What about the kavana? What about what was going on in their minds and hearts? That adds so much stake to any person's mitzvah. Right? We know that what goes into it in terms of the mind of heart and heart, it can make the difference between, so to speak, a generic brand of the same act or a real brand name. And you know, you could have two of the same product. One is $10 and the other is 500. So we're talking about intense limud Torah. We're talking about intense action, precision, with speed. It was very difficult business. That's what Kohanim's reason him. They had to be very, very on the ball. And on top of that, we're talking about the whole level of all the heart and mind that they were pouring into it, all the kavana, the deeper kavanas, without end. And this is all what made the difference in terms of the Hashras HaShchina and Klal Yisrael. And this really was set up such, because this was really meant to be the model of how Avodas Hashem is meant to look. Hashem does not, he's not interested in a nation. He didn't set up this whole system called Olam Hazeh and Torah and Olam Haba and Yemos HaMashiach. He didn't set it up for a Yetzer Zayin kind of approach. Like, you know, you do it, you get it done, approximately whatever, it works. That's not what he invested in. He was invested in something that we are going to give our all of our energy, all of our enthusiasm, our passion, our dedication. He wasn't interested in a cool, low flame kind of approach. It doesn't really work also. So here, just think in very practical terms. If a Kohen, take the young Kohen who started dividing his time between, he started throwing himself into the competitions in the gymnasium. And he's from Jew, Chas v'Shalom. He's not taking off his yarmulke. He's doing the avodah in the Beis HaMikdash. He's doing the avodah in the Beis HaMikdash. But his headspace is already rather divided. And there's going to be another competition tomorrow. And there's going to be some sort of championship in another month. And there's exercises to be done. And there's moves to be practiced, etc. You just think about it from a practically realistic angle and think of the difference in the atmosphere between what was before and what was now, that there's the gymnasium next door. And when the Kohen is busy doing the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash, his mind is there and he has his eye on the clock, and this is where his energies are being divided. And think about the difference between those who were a part of that and those who are just blotting out the existence of the gymnasium and were very upset about it, who are actually pouring in that much more passion now to their avodah. This is what the Bach is referring to when he talks about misrashlu, a certain laxness setting. We're not necessarily talking, it wasn't black and white. There was a long spectrum of those who completely ignored and resisted Greek culture, and from there to those who completely dropped the old ways for the sake of an absolute Greek identity, and there was everything in the middle. And this is what we're talking about when we say not that they dropped the avodah, but that nisrashlu ba'avodah, they became lax in the avodah. It started cooling. The level started dropping. Now here we talked about the Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, so we're talking about the Kohanim of the Beis HaMikdash because this was the peak of it all. Where was the rest of Klal Yisrael? So let's just picture that you have the same thing playing out all around Eretz Yisrael. You have the Greek influences there, and you have the people. Let's take the person living somewhere else in some city in Israel. He has the same question. The Kohanim were meant to be a model of what every person's personal and every home's individual avodah is meant to look like. Something that is a dedicated, passionate business. That's where your headspace is. That's where your emotional energies are. The material existence, your business, your parnasa are meant to be things that you go through the motions. You do what you need to do. It's technical, but that's not where the headspace is. That's not where the aspirations are. Here, there are suddenly new aspirations all around Eretz Yisrael. These things were going on all around Eretz Yisrael. The Greeks are now a presence. And you had, yes, somewhere else, the family who was completely ignoring it, and the family who was, again, like we said, making the best of both worlds. But whereas up till then, you have to appreciate, see, we're after 2,000 years of Golos, where we're already, so many other things were are a part of our lives, but there was no other culture then for. I think I've said it here, but Victor Miller explained. People, I only saw, someone saw this word, he thought it was a joke, but it's because you don't get the historic context. He said the reason why we don't, girls are not supposed to learn Gemara, he said, is because Gemara, it's not a field of study. It's a culture and a pastime. We don't want boys and girls sharing the same realms of interest. Of pastime. We want, we'll say in today's terms, we want boys in basketball and football, and we want girls in, I don't know, whatever they're, we don't want them mixing together because that gets dangerous. Gemara or Omelat Torah was a culture. That's how one of the historians says that we're talking about not so long ago in Krakow in the time of the Ramah. He said children battled the Torah in the street, and therefore there were women's interests and realms and men's interests and realms. And since Torah is meant to be such a culture, such a way of life, that's what you schmooze about. Like when you meet, when two boys met, it wasn't about all the million different types of things that hold our interest today, but it was about, so what did you say about this Rambam? That was really how just the schmoozing was meant to be. That's how it was. But this, of course, was now being affected by other competing interests and pastimes. And this was causing a general cooling. Cooling to the level of completely dropping it, but that's not what we're focused on now. We're focused on the cooling. It was cooling. And the dedication. And the passion and the exclusive dedication, the enthusiasm, all this was cooling. That was what the Aveira that the Bach is calling Nisrashlu min Arvoy. And here's where the Gezeira came. The Gezeira was basically Hashem said, okay, this is not the version of Yiddishkeit that I planned, this is not what I had in mind. If this is what you want, then drop it. We'll just take it all away. This put people up against, when Xeris actually came and said, okay, no more Torah. Now, this actually created an interesting dynamic because now, suddenly, there was no such thing as balancing both worlds. Either at this point, you either dropped it all, or now, if you just wanted to keep Shabbos up till then, there was no problem. You could keep Shabbos and read up on the latest Greek competitions after the Seder, right? But now, if you wanted to keep Shabbos, it was going to require a lot of intensity, passion, and dedication. Because in order to keep Shabbos, you had to leave your home, you had to pick up your whole family, all the little kids, and go out into the caves. You know what that looked like? This hit me. When I visited right out of Beit Shemesh here, Me'arat HaTaumim. You go there, you see what we're talking about when we talk about the caves. You go in there, it's a deep, deep cave. Up till then, I thought, you know, when I was growing up, I thought a cave is like, you know, a hole in the side of a mountain, right? You go in there, after you've walked a minute, you could have gone in there right in broad daylight, right? After you've walked inside for a minute, literally 60 seconds in, you're already somewhat deeply in. It's pitch black. It's pitch black. There's absolutely no daylight. And it's chilly, even when it's hot. It's chilly and it's moist, right? And everything is wet. It's actually slippery stones. Forget about the bats. That's just disappointing. We try to see them and we can't. But it's moist, it's chilly, and you go all the way in, it's very, very deep. Go further and further in. This is where you're taking all your children now. And this is the only way to keep Shabbos. And by the way, You're not putting up chowder and chicken soup there. You don't know where food tomorrow is going to come from. You have to picture it in very, very real terms. It wasn't just, oh, like this romantic scene of, wow, everybody just moved all the, Yiddish life over to deep in the caves. And it was all to realize what existence in a cave was. I guess every day I imagine that they had to make these, I had to have some of the tougher chevra make these, steel out of the cave to see what they can bring back. Now, you could still keep Torah and mitzvahs, but by definition, that meant intense dedication, intense sacrifice. It was the only way to keep anything at this point. If you wanted to learn Torah, if you wanted to do Bris Milah, all the things that we do very easily that we take for granted, now Hashem brought it to a place where either you are going to completely give your all, even your life, or just forget about it. There was no such thing anymore. I reached the point that there was no such thing as lukewarm Yiddishkeit. There was no such thing as low flame. It was either with all of your dedication or not. And here, Klal Yisrael proved themselves. Now, this also we have to qualify because not everybody did. You know that. It wasn't like, let's not have this fairy tale like picture of Hanukkah that everybody came back. It was far the story of Hanukkah in practical terms was a lot more dreary than we might picture when we're sitting around the table with the latkes and donuts, even when the nes happened. And that's actually a part of the significance of the story. It was about sacrifice. It was about okay, well, let's see what we could still develop now.
A story from the Second World War. Family who actually lived
Okay, if you are, so th this is what we're talking about. This is what we're talking about. So when the Bnei Israel showed, now Hashem said, came with that question and said, okay, now there's no more middle ground anymore. Either you're all the way or you're all the way out. Make your choice. And we had the scores and scores of Klal Yisrael who made that choice, and he moved out to the caves. And yes, many were burned and hung and tortured because they made their choice. And Hashem said, ah, obviously we're talking about in very short, simple terms. But this was a process that was going on for years. It wasn't like a quick story with Abia. The story of Hanukkah and the story of Purim were very, very different in this sense. Purim was a very straightforward, happy ending, celebration in the streets, happily, well, for some time after kind of story. Hanukkah wasn't. The victory was never straightforward. The celebration was always, well, exactly what we're going to say momentarily. And here Hashem said, oh, you are showing that dedication, you're showing that passion. Now you've rectified the mistake. You've rectified the mistake of the cooling by showing that no, now for every mitzvah, you're going to be willing to give everything you have and beyond, even your lives. And that's why now I am going to crown your efforts with that Yeshua. You're going to be, see those supernatural, the supernatural results, the supernatural Yeshua, where yes, you are going to regain the privilege of a life of Torah and mitzvahs. It's something you're going to get it back in reward. And therefore, the Chachamim came and said, we were granted that reward. We're going to rectify the mistake we said before. We're going to show our appreciation for that reward. We're going to relate to the ability to do Torah and mitzvahs, not as an encumbrance, but as a privilege which we're appreciating, and therefore we're going to respond by that much more hallel by the mitzvah of Hadlokas Neiros. Now, here we should insert a point. There seems to be a little bit of a discrepancy in the way we set it up. Because who was Lex? The Hellenizers were Lex. They stayed Lex. And the Siavnim fought alongside the Greeks against the loyal. That was like in communist Russia. We had the Absentia who was spearheading the efforts to stamp out Yiddishkeit more fanatically than the non-Jewish communists. Who showed that dedication? Presumably those who were always loyal. So where was the rectification? Follow the question? We say that they made a mistake and then they rectified it. But fine, the bulk of the hell, I don't know what the numbers were, but Hellenizers stayed Hellenizers afterwards. They ended up evolving into the Tzdukim, etc. The loyal were loyal all along. So where was the rectification? So we'll just finish this off briefly by saying there are two points which are both true. I don't know which one the Bach meant. Maybe he meant a third thing. But there are two points to be said here which are both true. And one is that really it's like we discussed before. It wasn't black and white. There were the Hellenizers and they were the loyal and that's it. There was a whole swath of gray of different shades in the middle. And like we said before, we can presume that, yes, when it hit that point where, okay, you're either in or you're out, that did cause many of the gray in between to turn around and say, whoa, we didn't realize where it was heading. We didn't realize how we were dropping another thing into nothing. Now that I'm being put up against the wall, I don't want to drop this. I'm turning around and I'm going all the way. I'm going out to the cave. And presumably there were those who said, oh, well, if it's at this point already, then just forget about it. The old ways are shaykh to the past. So this was a wake-up call. Where's your dedication? Where's your passion? Is it there or is it not? And if it's getting a little too gray, Hanukkah was the jolt that said, no. We have to realize that if we want it to be acceptable to Hashem, if we want it to be the version of Yiddishkeit that Hashem is interested in, we have to give it all of our enthusiasm, all of our dedication. But there's another point, and that is that, and this is something that's very relevant to us today. We've said this a few times. And that is that at times where, unfortunately, many of Klal Yisrael are not living the way Hashem wants them to live. And sometimes you look around and there's like a certain feeling of like, yeesh, how is this all going to change? Where is it going to go? What is Hashem expecting? Everyone's going to suddenly turn around overnight. So there's another point, and that is the understanding that the law, the quantity can be compensated by quality. Meaning, if you look at a door where, let's say, a door where many of them are weak or just off, and you have a relatively a minority who are loyal, who are holding on, and you think, okay, so where is this all headed? The purpose of this door might be for those who are loyal to compensate for the quantity with quality. Meaning, Hashem is not getting the quantity. He's not getting all the masses. Unfortunately, many are not there. We can compensate with that. We can give him extra quality. This is a pasuk that says in Mishlei, and this will end. This deserves more elaboration, but I'll just throw it out. The beginning of this pasuk is famous. The Hadras, everybody's familiar with that pasuk. It says that it's a mitzvah is of greater quality when it's done Beroiv'am, with multitudes. But there's a continuation to the pasuk that's less famous, meaning Beroiv'am Hadras means a lot of a great amount of people who are involved in the avoid of the Melech, that brings him greater glory. The continuation is which will just translate that straight. It's with when there's a dearth, when there's a lack of nation, it's the fear of the ruler. When there's a lack, it's the fear of the ruler. Now, what does that mean? So the Metzudah says what that means is as follows. Says when there's when there are multitudes performing the will of the king, his glory is in that fact, in the fact that look at the multitude serving him. But when there are minimal people serving him, where does his glory come from? It comes from the level of awe that they have for him. It comes from, yes, it might only be a handful, might be a minority, but their dedication, their awe of the king is at a level that is that itself begins to be. It's not many people. But look how dedicated they are to him. Look at the level with which they relate to him. And that actually compensates. It compensates for the lack of the quantity. So this is something. So on the one hand, we shouldn't look at it with despair. We've seen in recent times how there can be very, very broad awakenings among the people. Never give up. Never give up on the masses. Yes, we do hope to actually see awakenings and to see mass levels of things turning around. We do hope to see that. But at the same time, let's appreciate that we hold the power of compensating when there is a lack of the masses, when it's not enough people, when the loyal are a minority. We hold the power of compensating, kibiyachol, of bringing Hashem the same level of nachas ruach by stepping up the quality, the level of the dedication, the level of the enthusiasm for Hashem, the level of awe that we have for Hashem, of yiras Hashem, of asvas Hashem, and that can actually bring Hashem the full level of nachas and perhaps even more than he would have gotten had the whole nation been serving him. So, okay, we touched on the. It's a pasuk in Mishlei that says, "Beroiv am hadras melech, ubeefes loy mechitas rozein," and that's how the Mitzudis interprets the pasuk.
Where were the men Yaakov? They wiped down a whole city. When Dina was abused, right? Where were they when all these gazebos were put on? Why didn't they go wipe them all out?
So that's what that was a question hanging in the air until Matisyahu stepped up and said, "I'm going to be the B'nai Yaakov," and he did just that. He did just that. Oh, so that's a good question. You know what? That really deserves more length than we have now. I was just going to ask if we have a shiur next week. I'm not sure. You know, first we'll sign off.
This kind of thing. I don't know how to even know these things.